Any and all views expressed on the Devil in the Details are entirely my own. While I am a member of the Church of Satan, I do not speak for the Church of Satan. Devil in the Details. I'm the Satanic Skeptic, and this is going to be another mini-episode. This was originally going to be an article I submitted to the magazine Free Inquiry. I saw a headline for a Fox News article, "Christians Point to Genetics Breakthroughs to Show Adam and Eve Are Not Incompatible with Evolution." So, of course, I had to read it. The article claims that evolutionary science is making room for Adam and Eve according to Christian scientists. Perhaps not surprisingly, Fox News makes no mention of what Jewish scientists or Islamic scientists had to say on the matter. Anyway, the article was primarily an interview with an associate professor of the Washington University School of Medicine, S. Joshua Swamidas, and discusses his book, The Genealogical Adam and Eve. According to Swamidas, for over 160 years, the societal conflict over evolution has been deep and stubborn. But now, in a surprise twist, evolutionary science is making space for Adam and Eve. It turns out that the theological questions are about genealogical ancestry, not genetics. In this paradigm shift, we are finding a better way forward, a better story to tell. Now, Swamidas says, "it turns out," as though, all this time, theologians were asking the wrong questions, or asking them the wrong way. But, in actuality, Swamidas is arguing something that requires some pretty big assumptions to be made, and these assumptions are not likely to be accepted by many Orthodox theologians. But before we get into that, let's back up a second and examine why Swamidas thinks we ought to reconsider the relationship between evolutionary science and the biblical creation story in the first place. Swamidas makes it clear from the first page that his goal, quote, "is to make room for our differences, even as we maintain our own beliefs and practices. We all come from different starting points. Some are certain Adam and Eve are a myth. Some are certain evolution is a myth. Whatever the truth of the matter, let us travel together for a moment seeking a common good." That's from his book, The Genealogical Adam and Eve. What is the common good? According to Swamidas, making room for differences as an ongoing civic practice of science rooted in three aspirations: tolerance, humility, and patience. In other words, Swamidas believes scientists who believe in evolution, and Christians who believe in God and the Bible and creation, ought to get along and respect one another. And that's a nice sentiment. We should accord a base level of respect and courtesy to others unless they've demonstrated themselves unworthy of it. But that has nothing to do with whether or not the biblical creation story is supported by evidence. No matter how nice a sentiment it might be that we all get along and respect each other's beliefs, if we're talking about just the facts, either there's evidence to support the biblical narrative, or there's not. So, what exactly is Swamidas's argument? According to Swamidas, whom I must credit for acknowledging the claim may or may not be true, it is possible that Adam was created out of dust, and Eve out of his rib, less than 10,000 years ago. Leaving the garden, their offspring would have blended with those outside it, biologically identical neighbors from the surrounding area. In a few thousand years, they would become genealogical ancestors of everyone. This genealogical hypothesis posits that all humankind shares genealogical ancestry in Adam and Eve, but the DNA of our ancestors comes from the pre-Adamite humanoids with whom Seth and Cain intermingled with. That's our genetic ancestry. In this way, supposedly, one can simultaneously believe in both the Genesis account of creation while also believing that Homo sapiens sapiens share a common ancestry with primates. Before we go much further, let's be clear about the difference between genealogical and genetic ancestry, because the entire premise hinges on that distinction. According to Matheson and Scaley, genealogical ancestry is defined in terms of identifiable ancestors in your family tree or pedigree, and as such, reflects the most common and intuitive understanding of the term ancestry. By contrast, genetic ancestry refers not to your pedigree, but to the subset of paths through it by which the genetic material in your genome has been inherited. Because parents transmit only half their DNA to offspring each generation, an individual's genetic ancestry involves only a small proportion of all their genealogical ancestors. There are most recent common ancestors, MRCA, that we genetically all share. This is not controversial. It's a fact, and understanding why this is the case will help us understand why our most recent common ancestors were nothing like the biblical Adam and Eve that Swami Das is defending. We all have mitochondrial DNA in our cells, which could only have been passed to us from our mothers, and from our maternal grandmothers, and so on and so forth. This means, regardless of our gender identity, there is an unbroken lineage that we can trace through our mitochondria. Likewise, if on the 23rd pair of chromosomes you happen to have an X and a Y, you could only have received that Y chromosome from your father, and from your paternal grandfather, and so on and so forth. By tracing the unbroken chain of mtDNA back far enough within a given population through gene sequencing, we arrive at the mitochondrial most recent common ancestor, or, if you like, mitochondrial Eve. Likewise, if you trace the unbroken chain of Y chromosomes, you arrive at the Y chromosomal most recent common ancestor, or Y chromosomal Adam. So, yes, it's statistically necessary that we all share a single common male and female ancestor. But there's a catch. I actually reached out to one of the most well-known biologists I was familiar with, and someone whom I didn't think would be able to resist my inquiry, Richard Dawkins. And, much to my surprise, Dawkins actually responded, explaining with respect to mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam, and I'm going to try and do my best Richard Dawkins impression here. They never met and were separated from each other by probably many thousands of years. This is beyond ridiculous. If the website quotes him accurately, Swami Das is an ignorant fool, and I wouldn't dignify him with a reply. Well, there seems to be some debate on the question of when mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam may have lived, and whether or not those timelines overlapped, as Michael Hammer, a population geneticist from the University of Arizona in Tucson, explains. Because of the random nature of genealogy, he says, two different genetic lineages are unlikely to have common ancestors who lived in the same population at the same time. Ultimately, the designations of mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam are purely conceptual and, unfortunately, biblical. They do not in any way suggest the biblical Adam and Eve of the creation narrative. There's a further problem with the genealogical Adam and Eve that Swami Das readily admits, namely, there's no scientific evidence for or against them, meaning Adam and Eve. So, you know, that's a pretty big fucking problem, I think. Swami Das can't use science to prove the biblical narrative because, you know, there's no evidence to support it. So he thinks that by demonstrating that science at the very least doesn't disprove the biblical narrative, that's somehow convincing. This lack of evidence is conveniently dismissed by Swami Das, claiming Adam and Eve could have been de novo created or chosen from a larger population. They could have been in the Middle East or some other part of the world. They could have been in a supernaturally created garden, free of death, or in an environment much like our own. Those outside the garden could be in the image of God or not. Sure. And it might very well be the case that Adam and Eve were extraterrestrials, as ancient astronaut proponents claim. This list of possibilities covers any potential objections to a lack of evidence, and the believer is free to pick and choose among them. In this way, proponents of the genealogical hypothesis would be able to claim Adam and Eve are not incompatible with evolution without having to bother producing any actual evidence that Adam and Eve existed. The question is not whether the biblical Adam and Eve are impossible. Rather, the question is, are the biblical Adam and Eve probable? Is it reasonable to believe in the existence of the biblical Adam and Eve? Our beliefs should always be provisional, subject to revision, and in proportion to the best available evidence. There is no genetic or archaeological evidence that Adam and Eve ever existed, or any such place as the Garden of Eden ever existed. If someone wants to argue, well, of course not, they're supernatural, then it doesn't work to say science doesn't say they can't exist, or science doesn't say they're incompatible with evolution, because you've already moved the question beyond the scope of scientific inquiry. The supernatural, by definition, is that which is beyond the purview of science to understand or explain. Biology and genetics, of course, aren't the only branches of science, and if Swami Das would look beyond evolutionary science, granting that it doesn't disprove the biblical narrative, He still runs into a problem, as Ken Miller, professor of biology at Brown University, explained in a session of the American Academy of Religion in 2020. Adam and Eve are embedded in a demonstrably false narrative in terms of geology and natural history. Light is created, the sky is created, then we get dry land, plants and trees, and those plants are somehow flourishing without the presence of the sun. Finally, we have creatures that live in the sea and creatures that fly, and those creatures that fly are created a day before creatures that live on the land. The evolutionary sequence shows clearly that creatures on the land gave rise to creatures that fly. Of course, one could always argue, well, maybe the details are wrong, but the gist of the biblical story is true. But here's the thing. If the details are wrong, if whoever the authors of the Torah were, and they got these wrong, doesn't that call the whole story into question? Miller also makes the point that the genealogical hypothesis is needlessly complex. If the natural process of evolution can give rise to human beings, why would God need to specially create Adam and Eve de novo? Why would God have created Adam and Eve with DNA and mRNA, which they necessarily would have had to have had to be able to breed with the pre-Adamite humans? Did God always plan for Adam and Eve to reproduce sexually while in the garden? Wouldn't that have implied that at some point, without having eaten of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, they would have recognized that they were both, you know, naked and kind of sexy? How did pre-Adamite humans fit into the divine plan? Or were they just accidents of the process of evolution run amok? And while we're on the subject, the assumption of pre-Adamite humans is a theologically controversial idea on its own, and is not scripturally supported by either the Torah or the Bible, although I would say it is implied. After all, who else would Seth and Cain have been able to mate with? Some may argue that a work like the genealogical Adam and Eve represents some degree of progress, that if believers can cling to the idea that biblical stories are not incompatible with science, they'll be more accepting of science and less likely to protest what have traditionally been considered controversial topics, i.e. evolution. Certainly, Swamidas believes his book represents a very reasonable compromise between faith and facts. I would respectfully disagree, however, as any goodwill garnered from the religious comes at the expense of misrepresenting the principle of critical thinking, which is the foundation of the scientific enterprise. Science can't disprove the existence of Adam and Eve, or of God for that matter. You can't prove a negative. The burden of proof is not on science to prove that Adam and Eve are incompatible with evolutionary theory. The burden of proof is on the claimant. Saying that science can't disprove something is a not-so-clever way of shifting the burden of proof away from the claimant. Science will probably never disprove that Adam and Eve existed, but it also can't disprove that I have a pink elephant hiding in the trunk of my car. Go ahead. Try me. The genealogical Adam and Eve is not the apologetic triumph it sets out to be, although it certainly tries. It's neither a better way forward nor a better story to tell. And no, evolutionary science is not making space for Adam and Eve. The devil of doubt calls forth mankind to challenge all things, question all things. May the Luciferian light of reason guide you on your way, ever forward. Hail science! Hail reason! Hail Satan!